Good morning. Thank you. What a privilege it is to be in God's presence together. I feel a little bit like this just now. Do you ever feel overwhelmed by something when you're not quite able to take it all in? It can happen in a few different ways, right? It can happen when you hear or see something so beautiful and so powerful that you can't quite comprehend, you can't quite drink in that moment in all its fullness. And this last week, we saw these images that are going to come up on the screen of Venus passing the face of the sun on Tuesday and Wednesday. I don't know if you saw these images that NASA put out, but it is hard to not be wowed by images such as these. And it's a peculiar sort of emotion, isn't it? On the one hand, there's a sense of awe or even fear where you say, wow, I am so glad I'm not as near to the sun as the planet Venus is there. You know, it would not do me any good. You just get a sense of the magnitude and the power and the heat of the sun. But at the same time, as you look upon scenes like that, there's a sense of euphoria, a sense of excitement, a sense of wanting to know more about what you're seeing or what you're experiencing in that moment. In the Independent newspaper, there was a news report about this on Wednesday, and they wrote this, quote, Bo Tan from LA, a 32-year-old software engineer, took a half day off from work and went with his co-workers to the observatory. He admitted he wasn't an astronomy buff, but he could not miss this opportunity. He pointed his eclipse glasses at the sun and steadied his Nikon camera behind it to snap pictures. It makes you feel like a small speck in the universe, he said. Now that is interesting. This guy took a day off from work to go and with his co-workers look at something and enjoy that feeling of feeling like a small speck in the universe. That is interesting to me. And you don't have to go to the sun to get that. I suspect that if you went to the Grand Canyon, you would get the same place. That's one of the places on my list of places I'd like to see around the world. You don't go to the Grand Canyon to feel safe. You don't go to the Grand Canyon to feel very big about yourself, but you go and I imagine you feel small and you feel overawed at what you see there. But there's that same sense that it's good, that it's beautiful, something to drink in, not something to run from. And you can find yourself strangely at peace in that place of grandeur. You get the same feeling in big moments in our lives. If you start a new job, or if you've been given a special role at school to play, or if you've got, think about the time when the birth of a first child, and you get the sense of, wow, this is going to be a big moment, and there's a sense of trepidation and nervousness about that, but you feel excited to journey forward into such a moment. The Bible can have that sort of impact on us sometimes. Some parts of the Bible can be so weighty, so profound, that sometimes we find it hard to know how to respond. And we can, those passages can at the same time be stunningly glorious, and at the same time somewhat baffling or hard to grasp. We see it, for example, in Psalm 139. The psalmist, King David, is listing off all these things about God, that he was there when he was knit together in his mother's womb, that he knows every thought, that he knows the plans that he has. And then you remember what he says in verse 6. He says, such knowledge is just too wonderful for me. It's too lofty for me to attain. It's too much for me to get my head round. The psalmist just says, you know, I just need to acknowledge God. I can't fully understand who you are. Another example is from C.S. Lewis. On the 8th of June, 1942, Lewis preached a sermon in Oxford called The Weight of Glory. And in it, he speaks of the wonder of the truth that God delights in us. And this is what he says. The promise of glory is the promise, almost incredible and only possible by the work of Christ, that some of us, that any of us who really chooses, shall actually survive that examination when we stand before God, shall find approval, shall please God. He goes on, to please God, to be a real ingredient in the divine happiness, to be loved by God, not merely pitied, but delighted in, as an artist delights in his work or a father in his son, it seems impossible, a weight or burden of glory which our thoughts can hardly sustain. But so it is. End quote. The Bible is full of these sorts of weighty truths. And so often when we read the Bible, we want to break it down, don't we? Into kind of bite-sized chunks, little rules or principles or stories that we can digest easily. But we shouldn't do that. We mustn't run away from some of these weighty mysteries of what God has for us. We've been going through Ephesians, and no book, I say that word mysteries carefully, no book speaks of the mysteries of God more than the book of Ephesians. There's a number of times that Paul uses this word mystery. And in our passage today in Ephesians chapter 5, Paul wants to share with us a profound mystery. A profound mystery. And what we're looking at today, this passage is all about marriage. All about marriage. Now, I just want to say, as I've studied this, along with the commentary that I normally use, there were two books that were particularly helpful. And if you would like to learn more about this, I would recommend two books. One is, you can get it free online. It's an e-book called This Momentary Marriage by John Piper. And the other book is a very recent one called The Meaning of Marriage by Tim Keller. Just share that with you if you'd like to learn more of what I'm talking about today. Would encourage you to get those books. But when we think about marriage, you know, I wonder what you think about when you hear that word. I am so conscious that for many people here together this morning, they may immediately feel a sense of pain, a sense of hurt when they hear that word. Perhaps to do with a marriage that ended with the death of a spouse. Perhaps a marriage that ended in a brutal and painful breakdown in relationship. Perhaps a marriage which is currently in turmoil and you don't know how you're going to get through the week, let alone the year. Perhaps the sadness that can come as a result of a desire to be married which hasn't yet been fulfilled. All of these are very real and very significant situations, and they've been on my mind all week as I've been thinking about this passage. I've been praying that the peace and presence and comfort of God would saturate the room as we come around an issue like this, which can be very difficult for very many. So I'm conscious. Some might think of pain or hurt when they first hear the word marriage. Others may think of current debates that are going on. There are lots of cultural challenges that are coming against marriage. You know them all too well. And some of you may think of things like that. Some of you may think of your parents' marriage, whether it was good or bad, or whether it, you know, for the young people, whether it is good or bad. Don't raise your hand and answer. You can keep that to yourself. Some may think of, you know, just their current relationship with their spouse, some of the joys that can come through marriage as the years go by, and some of the challenges that can come, whether they're serious challenges or not so serious. For example, I heard the following definition of marriage. Marriage is when you agree to spend the rest of your life sleeping in a room that's too warm beside someone who's sleeping in a room that's too cold. You know, these are the sorts of challenges. These are profound difficulties that we have to wrestle with when we think about marriage. But listen, there are so many jokes about marriage. I'm sure you've heard more than enough in different best man's speeches across the years. And I'm not here to tell jokes today about marriage. That's not why we're here. We're here to take a trip to the Grand Canyon. We're here to come and gaze and try and grapple with this profound mystery of what marriage is, to feel the weight and the wonder of God's plan, God's desire for marriage. This is an incredible passage. I'm going to read from chapter 5, verse 22. The words will probably come up. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Paul's quoting there from Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, words that Jesus quoted as well. Verse 32, this mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. First question I want to ask is, what is marriage? What is marriage? The way that Paul speaks about marriage here is astonishing. It's incredible. He seems determined, does Paul, to lift our eyes away from the detail, from the often mundane ins and outs of married life, to an infinitely greater reality. He doesn't talk, when he speaks about marriage, he doesn't talk about date night. I know some of you have got a date night that you keep aside every week, which is fantastic. Paul doesn't talk about date night. He doesn't talk about the right way or the wrong way to squeeze the toothpaste tube. Any of you had those arguments? You can squeeze it from the bottom, or who cares? He doesn't talk about who should do what in the home. You know, who should do what jobs. That's not what Paul's interested in. He doesn't even talk about the five love languages. Have you read that book? You know that you've got a love language and you don't speak the same love language as your spouse, and you need to learn to speak their language and all the rest of it. I struggle with that book because I'm convinced that Lindsay speaks all five love languages. And she wants me to speak all five, and I was never good at languages anyway. It just doesn't seem fair to me. Paul doesn't speak of any of these kind of practical things. Instead, he points us to this much deeper, more glorious understanding of what marriage is. And this is such a challenge for us, because our understanding of what marriage is formed by our experiences of it. It's formed by the experience of marriage in our day-to-day life. You know, from the point when someone gets married, it takes very little time before they're confronted with the sort of day-to-day reality of life, the housekeeping, finances, doing the garden, paying bills, school trips, pressures at work. All these things creep in, and when we think of marriage, that can be often what we think of. And things can change very quickly in a marriage. Lindsay and I are married just over our 9 years. And even in that short time, we've changed so much in terms of how we communicate with one another. This week, I came across a bunch of text messages that we'd sent to each other from 10 years ago. And me being me, I can sometimes be a bit crazy with stuff like this. I typed all the dialogue of our text message conversation into a Word document and saved it. And I found it, right? And I was reading it, and it was just so interesting how differently we communicate to one another. Lindsay said this, she goes, you know what's really interesting? You call me by my name a lot. That seemed concerning to me, because I'm like, what do I call you now? I'm sorry, you know, oi, you, no, I'm like, okay, but we've changed over time, and our daily routine can end up defining what we understand marriage to be. And Paul wants to lead us away from that. Paul wants to lead us away not just towards a deeper, you know, more profound love for our spouse, but in expressing what marriage is, Paul points us in two remarkable directions, okay? First of all is verse 31. Paul points us back to creation, quoting from Genesis chapter 2, where God first instituted marriage. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. If you go back and look in Genesis chapter 2, you see that almost immediately after creating Adam, God says what? He says, it's not good for the man to be alone. Amen? I thought there'd be more women amening that than men. before it's interesting, before sin enters the world, before the fall of man, before sin comes, God brings about this unique and beautiful covenant relationship where a man and a woman leave all that has gone behind them to be united together by God. Remember, Jesus says, he quotes this verse and he says, therefore, what God has joined together. So God does this. God brings two people, joins them together as one flesh in this covenant relationship. And here's the question. Why? Why did God do this? Have you ever wondered that? It wasn't just because men aren't good at being alone. It wasn't just so that a man and a woman can enjoy times of intimacy and love together. But even in those earliest days of creation, God was foreshadowing something. This marriage covenant between a man and a woman was to point somewhere, was to point to something infinitely more lasting and infinitely more glorious. And Paul makes this clear in the next verse, in verse 32. This mystery, the one I've just talked about, of a man and woman becoming one flesh by God, this mystery is profound. And I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. This mystery of God taking two and making one is not just a mystery for the blessing in the here and now, but it refers to something. It points to something. It's a picture of something. It's a shadow of a greater reality, namely the relationship between Jesus Christ and his church. The covenant of marriage ultimately, most ultimately, yes, it exists for other things, but most ultimately exists to point to the covenant of Jesus Christ with his church. Paul has pointed back to creation, and now he wants to point us forward to something which we know in part now, but which one day we will know in all its fullness. That relationship between Jesus and his bride, the church, his people. I wonder if you agree that this is, to use Lewis's phrase, a weight of glory. As you think about your marriages, as you think about people who have been married, this is breathtaking. This is precious beyond words. When we think for a moment, we've just been singing about the wondrous cross. We think about Jesus' love for us, his church, and the covenant commitment that he has made towards us, that covenant which was made possible through the shedding of his blood on the cross. When we think of Jesus' relationship towards us, that our marriages here on earth are supposed to paint a picture of that to the world, is a lot to take. It's a heavy, it's an astounding weight of glory. Tim Keller says this, "This is the secret," he's talking about the mystery that Paul talks about there, "that the gospel of Jesus and marriage explain one another. That when God invented marriage, he already had the saving work of Jesus in mind. The reason that marriage is so painful and yet wonderful is because it is a reflection of the gospel, which is painful and wonderful at once. The gospel is this: we are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared believe. Yet at the same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared hope." So if that's true, if that's what marriage is most ultimately about, the question is, how on earth does that happen? How does that play out? If marriage is supposed to point people towards Jesus' love for his people, how is that going to happen? And the answer from this passage in Ephesians is that it's all to do with the way that husbands and wives relate to each other. That's what these earlier verses, from verse 22 onwards, are pointing towards when we get to the point of verse 32. These verses lead towards this mystery of marriage being about Christ and the church. And it talks there in verse 22 to 31, it talks about men, wives acting in a certain way, and it speaks about husbands acting in a certain way. And we'll take them in the same order as the passage does from verse 22. When we think of this passage from verse 22 to 24 about wives, the key word here is submit. Now,
to some of you, I know that just based on conversations I have with different Christians, some of you, that's like a swear word, right? You hear the word submit and you immediately are begin, you know, a yeah, but jumps into your mind. Or perhaps you might even have a much more vociferous, strong reaction towards it. But I think and I pray that as we look not to our own flawed experiences, but to what God desires in these verses, that we'll see something of God's heart for women in marriage. But before that, there is merit in some qualification here, because verse 22, we need to recognize, flows directly out of verse 21, okay? And we need to read the verse before, because this sets the context for what's going to come. Paul's talking about a life being filled with the Spirit. And remember, a few weeks ago, we looked at what that means. And one of the things that marks a life filled by the Spirit is that we will submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Paul makes clear that the mutual submission is something that all believers should embrace towards one another. And these verses are actually so closely tied together that the word submit isn't even in the Greek in verse 22. It's read as an implication of verse 21. So here's how it's written. Submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives to your husbands as to the Lord. So it's important just to bear that in mind, that all brothers and sisters in God's family are to mutually submit to one another. Right. While that's true, verses 22 to 24 are the first of some specific commands that Paul has for wives in particular. And at the heart of this word submission is the notion that God has ordered things in a certain way. The notion of order. The sense that God has put out the world in a certain way. He's established certain roles of leadership. And that should be the case within marriage. God's intention is verse 23, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. That the husband has responsibility for her, that he is the leader within the relationship of marriage. The thrust of these verses is that wives, importantly, without any sense of being forced to do so, and that's important, but the wives should willingly and gladly acknowledge the fact that God has ordered men and women within marriage in a certain way, and that they should seek to live within that sense of order that God has put in place. So that's going to impact all sorts of things. Again, Paul doesn't give detail, but that's going to impact how she thinks about her husband, how she speaks to him, how she speaks about him to her kids, how she considers his advice, how she spends her time. It will impact her whole life. Paul isn't interested in giving lots of detail here about what this word submission means. But the truth is, if we take a plain reading, the concept, the principle of the concept, is not overly difficult for us to get our heads around. But it is a concept and a principle that can be very easily abused. Very easily abused when the following verses aren't paid attention to. And the reality is that this is an abused word in the church and outside of the church. We live in a fallen world, and any person here who has experienced a marriage relationship has experienced the result of that, the sin where men have not been the head of their wives in the way that God intended it to be, but they've sinned and they've fallen short and they've messed it up. Around the time when Lindsay and I were getting married, a bunch of our friends were at the same time, and there was so much talk about this word submit, about whether you were going to have the word submit in your vows or not, and some were arguing passionately your vows had to have submit. There was all this talk about submission, and not hardly any talk about the following verses. And that's wrong. That's wrong. That's wrong. And that's what we're going to turn to look at just now. The submission of a wife to her husband is to be understood in the context of what is expected of her husband. I didn't say it's dependent on her husband matching up perfectly, but submission is to be understood from within the context of how a husband is to live. Now, We need to think about the context of the day, right? When Paul was writing this, women were viewed as second-class citizens. Women weren't allowed education. They had to worship in a different area of the temple. They weren't allowed to speak in public. There was even a daily Jewish prayer, which Jewish men would say. It went like this: "Praise be to God, he has not created me a Gentile. Praise be to God, he has not created me a woman. Praise be to God, he has not created me an ignorant man." You know, that's the sort of context, right, that Paul is writing Ephesians into. Now, into that sort of context, what would you expect the corresponding command for submit to be? If wives are supposed to submit, what would you expect the corresponding command for men to be? Wives, submit to your husbands. Husbands, rule your wives. Husbands, govern your wives. Lead your wives. Husbands, direct your... No, Paul doesn't say any of that. This is what Paul says. Husbands, love your wives, as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. This is where any concept of cruel, detached, unfeeling dominion, we just have to completely reject it. If we see it, we have to speak to it. If one of your brothers is acting in that way, you need to challenge him on it. If you see signs of it, you need to we just need to push this, that sort of false understanding completely away. This concept of mutual submission that Paul talked about in verse 21 is now elevated to a brand new level. It's now taken much further. Paul defines leadership in the most incredible way. Husbands are to love wives in the same way as Jesus loves the church. Is that, you know, I don't know if there's a more challenging command anywhere in the scriptures. How did Jesus love the church? Well, it says there, he loved the church and he gave himself up for it. He gave himself. He denied himself. You remember Philippians chapter 2, that he made himself nothing. He took the very nature of a servant. What does a servant do? A servant, we're going to find next week, a servant is to submit. Jesus took on the very nature of one who submits, and any power and glory that he had, he put it all aside for the sake of his bride, the church, so that ultimately that bride could share in his glory, which is rightly his. And this is what verses 26 and 27 are about. They just add color to this already beautiful picture that Paul's laid out. Listen, he's talking about what Jesus, how Jesus acts towards his bride, the church, and trying to understand how husbands are to act, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. It's just a picture of perfect care and attention. And the challenge is for a husband to do everything possible to beautify, to clean, to protect, to purify, to bless in the marriage relationship. That's what Paul's getting at. So as we think about wives and as we think about husbands, and now we think about that together, in light of that sort of leadership, then surely submission becomes the most natural and right response. If men are really loving, husbands really loving their wives like that, anything else would be strange. Be like if a husband turned up one morning and had flowers for his wife, and he'd arranged a babysitter, and he'd bought his wife a beautiful new dress to put on, and had planned carefully a day which would just thrill her, maybe a trip to a beauty spa or something like that, something that she would just love, and a way that he could practically show his love towards her, to do what would bring her the most joy and satisfaction, to delight in her. And as he turned up and as he explained his plan to his bride, you know, if that wife were to sort of spit back at him, yeah, look at you trying to be the big leader. You know, you want me to submit to your plan, don't you? I'm not going to submit to you. You know, it just would be so bizarre, wouldn't it? It'd just be such a strange response. Leadership is something that, when it's done right, that people will respond correctly to. John, one of my favorite passages is John chapter 13. Jesus is there with his disciples, and I just love the way John sets it up in verse 3 of John chapter 13. Jesus knew that all power, let me read it right before I get it wrong. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God, and that he was returning to God. So, right? And he's going to go on to describe something. You know, so talking about the power of Jesus, where Jesus has come from, the authority, the grandeur, the majesty of Jesus. So Jesus is about to do something. And you remember, some of you know the passage. What does Jesus do? He gets up from the table. He removes his outer garment. He puts a towel around his waist and he washes his disciples' feet. Now, do you think as Jesus did that submissive act of a servant, do you think there was any doubt in the disciples' minds whatsoever who the leader was in the room? Of course not. John Piper writes this, submission and servanthood do not cancel out the reality of leadership and headship. And this is quote, it's just so helpful, I think. Servanthood does not nullify leadership, it defines it. Servanthood doesn't nullify leadership, but instead it defines it. Man, is this not a weight of glory? Is this not a heavy burden to consider? Your behavior in your marriage, in your leadership, is to look like Jesus' servant leadership. This is how it's to work. This is how marriage is to paint a picture of Christ and the church, because in marriage, the world should see, it should just catch a glimpse of the servant leadership of Christ towards his people, laying down his life for them, and they in turn responding in joyful submission, honoring that leadership, loving that leadership. That is what marriage is to present to the world. Such a challenging, such a beautiful picture. Marriage is hard. Marriage is hard. I found this quote, Stanley Hauerwas. I just loved it. It's a real reality check. We always marry the wrong person. We never know whom we marry. We just think we do. Or even if we first marry the right person, just give it a while and he or she will change. For marriage, being the enormous thing it is, means we are not the same person after we have entered it. The primary problem is learning how to love and care for the stranger to whom you find yourself married. As we think about this issue of marriage, with all the challenges that come, with all the challenges that have come, as we ponder what's gone before, as we ponder perhaps years and years of tears and pain, the question this morning is, how clear and well-focused is the portrait of Jesus Christ and the church in your marriage? And there are many here who are not currently married. And there's much that we can learn as we consider what it means to submit in the way that God would have us submit, in mutual submission towards one another. For all of us, as we're married or not, as we consider our lives in light of Christ's self-emptying, the question is, how will we respond? Dietrich Bonhoeffer says this, in a word, live together in the forgiveness of your sins. For without it, no human fellowship, least of all a marriage, can survive. We need to, in order for us to paint a picture of Christ's relationship to his church, we need to embrace the reality of that picture for ourselves. And we need to embrace all that Jesus has done for us in dying on the cross, that we can rest in his forgiveness. Him who will one day present us in splendor, without spot or blemish, without wrinkle or without stain. Can we just bow our heads and pray? I wonder whether we can stand and just keep our hearts in an attitude of prayer. Let's all stand, please.
And I just want to give people an opportunity to be prayed for this morning as we consider this calling on our lives. Whether we're married or not, we can respond to what is required and challenged of us in these passages. What I want to ask is, first of all, for any men who have heard this challenge to love their wives like Christ has loved the church, for any men who would just, and we're not here announcing huge marriage problems, but for any men who would just appreciate prayer, that they might be able to love their wives better as Christ loved the church, I'd love it if you would sit down in your seat where you are. Just sit down, and what I'd like to do is just invite the men around about you to pray. So are there any men here who would love to love their wives better as Christ loved the church? And I just ask the other men just to move out of their seats and just lay a hand on the men around about you and just pray for them just now. Can we do that? And likewise, as we think about wives submitting to their husbands joyfully and gladly, not expecting them to measure up perfectly, are there any wives here, are there any women here who would love just prayer for help with that this morning? Just invite you to sit down if that's you. And could the women just around the room just walk about just now and just lay a hand on your sister and just pray for them now. We sang earlier as we pray, you're the God of salvation. We call on your name. You came to redeem us. You carry our shame. We stumble and fall down. We turn from your ways. In you we find mercy. We're held in your grace. Held in your grace. The last group I want to just us to pray for is just people here who are just broken, hurting, in pain, devastated at what's happened in their lives. Struggling with the realities of memories that we have or what's going on just now. Would you just sit if that's you? And again, would the people around about them just lay a hand and just pray for those who have sat down? Father, you never give up on us. You never let go or turn away. You're strong and you're good, and sometimes we don't always, we're not able to see that, to understand it. Help us in this moment to hold on to you. Help us to cling on with all that we can. Help us in our relationships, in the relationships that we hope to one day have, in our lives as we consider what we've heard today. Help us to paint a beautiful picture of Christ in the church. Father, help the men in this church who are married to love their wives as Christ loved the church. And help the wives in this church to respond lovingly and gladly. May this be to the glory of your name.